Of History on a Magazine, and I'm your head schoolmaster for this afternoon's discussion. And this is our first stadium gig. It's a big step forward for us. And I think it's very appropriate that we have this discussion here today in the home of Irish football, Dalyman Park. Brian, were you saying to me this is football has been played here longer than anywhere else on the planet at this stage? That'd be true, this stadium.
If I said it, then it was brilliant, but no, it wasn't true.
what a PR man.
What I'm asking, perhaps rather than stating, is there anywhere in these islands, for example, or outside, where football has been played continuously by a club at the top level for 111 years? And I think it's extremely unlikely.
Right. I haven't even introduced the topic yet, by the way. We're still talking about the venue. The topic, of course, today is the Garrison Game, a history of Irish football. And here to discuss it, we have on my right here, Donal Fallon. Donal is one of the editors of the excellent Come Here To Me blog. And if you're interested in left-wing politics, local history, and the minutiae of League of Ireland football, a rather bizarre combination, Donal is your man. But Come Here To Me, check it out, Google it and check it out. It's full of, for example, did you know that this year is the 50th anniversary of the floodlights? Nowhere else would you find out that information except in
those are the same floodlights that went up in 1962.
And next to me, we have, of course, Brian Trench, who's a media officer of Bohemians. And then on my immediate left, we have Paul Rouse, who's a sports historian in UCD. And then on my far left, David Toms, who's a sports historian in UCC, but more importantly, he's a Waterford supporter. So he's given us the culture angle here today. And by the way, the man you see with the big smile on his face, Donal Fallon, of course, he's a Pat supporter. Bastards. Great game, though. Great game. I presume you were all here last night. It was the first time I've been here for a good number of years, actually, and a fantastic game. But I'll come back to that at the end. Paul Rouse, I want to go to you first, right, because I think before we start talking about the game in Ireland, I think we need to talk about the game maybe across the Irish Sea, where it was first, the rules were first formulated and so on. So how did the game of soccer develop as opposed to rugby or other ball games in Britain in the 19th century?
It did by accident. You look at soccer now, the game without doubt, with more supporters, more money, more players than any other game across the world. You look at its ubiquity and you look at its almost its supremacy over sports and you see it as inevitable almost, or a kind of a natural thing of events. And of course it wasn't, it was an accident. It didn't exist before 1863, before the Football Association was founded in England, in London, in the Freemasons Tavern. And
Freemasons? Ah, that's it then.
That's the Freemasons Tavern. No association, I don't think. But so before that, it wasn't, of course, the idea that a game of football was invented at that time. The game of soccer was invented at that time. But the idea of football as men or women or children kicking a ball had existed through millennia.
That's what I'm saying. I mean, people have been kicking around pigs' bladders, for
and,
centuries.
And much more than that. People have played organised football for centuries.
So basically the Brits were the first to write down the rules.
Yes, and it came as part of a process involving the Industrial Revolution, the number of people going to schools and people coming from the schools out into wider society to form clubs and agreeing a set of rules whereby people who went to different schools and played by different sets of rules in their schools could play a combined game together.
Would you see a link then between the discipline, say, on the football pitch and the discipline of the factory floor?
I see no link at all.
No link?
No link whatsoever. I think the idea of playing soccer was taken on by some factory owners after its existence, but that's cause and effect. It wasn't something that was there was the conspiracy theory that it was factory workers or factory owners and a wealth class who kind of formulated a game for the diversion of the working classes to keep them going on Saturdays so that they would work all the better during the week, and it's nonsense.
So just taking all that I've been flatly contradicted once already in this discussion. David, I want to move on to you. Which is, how did the game then spread into Ireland? Where did it first start being played?
I mean, the game itself began, I think, the first club that was properly founded was in Trinity, wasn't it? And I mean, kind of from there, it sort of spread itself. Different places seem to play it at different times. I know, for instance, that one of the first games to be played in Munster was in 1877 between a Lismore College and a college in Mallow. So kind of within kind of 10 years or so of it actually being set up and started to be played in England, it starts to make its way over here, which I suppose isn't that surprising in one way, because as well as everything else, you know, in terms of the Industrial Revolution, another thing, you know, as well as people going to school, what that also brought about, increased literacy, you know, newspapers are really expanding, you know, the availability of the rules here as well as in England kind of help to move it along, I think. So it starts kind of from more or less kind of 10, 15 years later, you start to see it here in both, and particularly in Belfast and Dublin. But it also, there's a little bit of it in Munster from kind of the late 1870s on as well.
But Paul, Belfast would have been the initial.
Oh, Belfast is the heartland of the game.
Yeah.
The first recorded match in Ireland is in 1878 when a Belfast linen merchant or clothing merchant, J.A. McCleary, invited two Scottish teams over, rented a cricket ground, let them out into the cricket ground, charged people in. And I suppose if you ever want to think about believing journalists and what they say, there was a newspaper report afterwards which condemned the players for running around butting at the ball like a pack of goats, number one, and number two, predicted that soccer would never take off in Ireland.
Tommy, just to,
like, is that true though, isn't it, after last night's display?
Yeah. Tommy, just to, like, Alex Blaney, the first chairman of Bowes,
yeah,
a former player at Cliftonville. Cliftonville are the first,
yeah,
Irish football club that are formed. Football in Ireland takes off among the Belfast working class at first.
Now, I wanted to move on to the title of this.
Just hold on, the social class thing is a little bit more complicated than that. Alex Blaney is a medical student when he joins the founding group for Bohemians, mm-hmm, and becomes a surgeon and a professor and continues his connection with Bohemians. In fact, the majority of that founding group of 18 were middle class professional background. And therefore, the notion that you had immediately jumped to about the factory teams and working class association with the game is not that clear at the start. And in fact, it doesn't become the major working class sport of Dublin until well into the 20th century.
But Dublin is an exception in that. If you look at Belfast, rugby was the middle class game in Belfast. Soccer is the working class game. If you go all across the north of England, it's both rugby and soccer. They're both shared, but the rugby that's played in the north of England becomes rugby league when it professionalises in the 1890s, but it is, you can't explain the spread of soccer in the north of England or in the north of Ireland without understanding the fact, like, why was it Belfast that came into? It came into Belfast because Belfast was, like Manchester and Liverpool, as Billy Bragg says, a northern industrial town. It was full of workers and it exploded in the 19th century. It began in around 1810, the population of Belfast was 25,000. By 1900, the population of Belfast was 330,000. It totally exploded, built around the linen industry and the shipbuilding. And that's, workers came in from Scotland, from England, and as well as an influence of Irish workers. And it was in that culture that soccer spread.
Brian, I want to come back to you, though, about Bowes, because we may drift away from this period hereafter. Right? Just could you tell us a little bit about how Bowes was established, what type of a club it was? Because Bowes was the first club that broke the northern monopoly. Won the, what was it?
Well, broke the northern monopoly on the cup. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. The first southern team to win the Irish Cup. Bowes was came out of three strands, I think, really, of founding members.
Why the name? Why the name, first of all? Why are they called Bohemians?
We don't know.
Anyone?
No. Seriously, I mean, we think it's got something to do with the idea that we were wandering around, but actually, they didn't wander around until after the Bohemians.
Well, the least wandered around League of Ireland club in existence, actually.
And we're still gypsies.
Yeah.
So it's
give a club a bad name, you know.
Yeah. But there were three groups involved, three sort of subgroups. Medical students, and Alex Blaney, who was mentioned, and his two brothers were part of that. The Sheehan family, they were medical students. There were civil service students. These are all 17, 18, 19, 20-year-olds, yeah? Many of them went on to distinguished careers subsequently in medicine and in the civil service and the administration, in the prisons board, in the local government, in Department of Agriculture and so on. And then there were some school students, and they were at a school in Phoenix Park called the Royal Hibernian Military School. And they set up to play association football, as it was called, and they played other sports. And the brother of Blaney, who was mentioned, played rugby for the Mater Hospital, and in the hospital's cup was a big feature of the sporting scene at the time.
So there is a tie-up with the British military in Ireland.
the Royal Hibernian Military School, as I understand it, was a school.
Right.
It wasn't a training school for officers. It was a secondary boarding school. It was co-educational.
Right.
But it had some kind of symbolic whatever connection with the military. No, the stronger connection is with civilians in the professions and in the civil service.
So that books against then the kind of the typical profile that we've been discussing here of industrial working class, right? So Bowles is somewhat exceptional then.
Well, so Bowles says exceptional, but the whole scene in Dublin is probably a bit exceptional.
Yeah.
Their first organised team was probably in Dublin University.
Okay, listen, I want to, because my question about the military connection is, I thought it would lead somewhere and it didn't. So I'm going to go there anyway, which is...
I knew where you were at.
Is the garrison game, right? Now, first of all, Donal, you did a bit of research, a bit of homework. Who first coined the term, the garrison game, as far as we know?
We don't know who coined it. Oscar Traynor, in particular, despised the term garrison game. But one person who definitely used it was Michael Collins. It's quite interesting. And Tim Pacoog, in his biography of Michael Collins, he quotes him as saying that, quote, garrison games assist in the peaceful penetration of our nation. And then he goes on to say there should be no soccer for the Gaels. So Collins is referring to garrison games in his time. When you remember that Collins would have spent some of his formative younger years in England, you know, as an emigrant in London. When Collins was in the UK, he was very active in GAA circles. But of course, the Irish migrant communities in Britain done very well with soccer in a lot of cases. It's interesting that Collins seemed to be very, very acutely aware of garrison games and what he saw as a threat of what they posed to Irish nationalism.
But I think it's interesting that it's Collins. I mean, we're already well into the 20th century before the term is used.
Yeah.
For the early risers this morning, we did a tour of sites associated with Bohemians, 1890s and so on. And one of those sites is Jones's Road. Bohemians played alongside the Dublin GAA peacefully in Jones's Road, at least relatively peacefully.
Right, I want to bring this gentleman here. Just give us your name, if you could, please.
Jerry Dewell. The garrison game, in actual fact, the military teams, the British military teams placed in the garrison towns around the country, actually played in the Leinster Senior Cup. You know, they never had any success at winning the cup, and that's probably part of where the garrison game, and that would go beyond Collins, because that's earlier.
Right, okay.
I found some Shelbourne playing the 10th Battalion of the Royal Dublin Fusiliers in 1916.
What extent do you think is the garrison game?
It is the garrison game in the sense that it was played by soldiers based in Ireland. And soldiers based in Ireland entered teams in organised competitions and entered, and one I can't remember the name of the regiment, won the IFA Cup in the early 1880s. You see regular match reports in the newspapers in the 1880s, 1890s, 1900s of British Army teams here. So to that extent it's a garrison game. But that's not the meaning of the term garrison game. It's a pejorative term coined by nationalist ideologues within the GAA in the early 1900s who, at that point, sought to create a divide between, and you're right, it was Michael Collins, who was also Harry Boland, who was instrumental in it. They tried to use Harry Boland's phrase, between the garrison and the Gael. That's what they tried to do, and that's why they introduced the ban on foreign games.
Now, when the ban came in and out several times, Paul, when did it come in finally?
It came in, first of all, there was an early ban in the 1880s, which was... A ban which is almost word for word a similar ban that the Football Association had in England on other teams, and it was to stop football clubs playing by other rules other than the rules of the GAA or the Football Association. That was dropped in the 1890s. It was reintroduced in stages between 1901 and 1905, and it basically set out by 1905 it set out that you could not play or watch Gaelic games soccer, rugby, cricket or hockey if you wanted to be a member.
Not golf, by the way. Golf was Scottish, so that was okay, apparently.
I think we claim to have invented golf in some sense.
Tennis was okay too, actually.
What's that?
Tennis was another one that was kind of given the AOK. And the idea...
You learned so much.
Apparently the idea was that... I remember reading in one newspaper report, they said that the atmosphere attending upon, say, rugby and so on, it was much more likely to kind of get you interested. Basically, it was... better game in terms of an audience participation thing, whereas tennis and golf and so on are slightly more solitary sports,
so they weren't as worried about people becoming kind of too enraptured by them. So they felt, I think, a little bit maybe more of a threat from rugby and soccer and so on, because you could actually go there in large groups. And I think that, you know, that seemed to be part of the distinction, was that some games were solitary, and so it didn't really have the same audience participation.
Brian, can I come back to you, because just let you develop that point about the relationship between between soccer and GAA at the earlier stage, because it's not as binary as we now kind of think of it.
Apparently not, but just before we before I lose the thought, two sports were played at Dalyman Park for the first 20, nearly 30 years of its existence. What do you think they were? Association football and
cricket?
Tennis courts down there, yeah. Which maybe also says something about the class background, I'm not quite sure, but anyway. The point I was merely making was that there was a place called the City and Suburban Racecourse in Jones's Road, where now Croke Park stands. And the Dublin GAA established itself there in the 1880s. And Bohemians played there from 1893 to 1895, and they were peacefully coexisting as co-tenants of the owners of City and Suburban Racecourse, who were the Butterley family. And it was also a place for athletics. And there were other sports. It was just all kinds of sports and recreation activities went on there. And I think the war between the games, you know, is part of the intensification, obviously, of the nationalist revival post-Gaelic, you know, setting up the Gaelic League and all of that from then on. You know?
Donal, could you bring us in there, because I think Bo's been hogging the limelight here. There were some other clubs in the city, yeah, well, were there not?
Ourselves and Pats, we come along later. We don't come along to the late 1920s. But even in the late 19th century, Shelburne followed in 1895. They were founded in the Shelburne hostelry. Like all good Irish ideas, they came out of a pub collection for their first kits in the Shelburne hostelry on the Shelburne Road. So Shells come along in 1895 in Ringsend. Another Ringsend club come along then in either 1899 or 1901 on Glenmalure Park on Milltown Road. It would say Shamrock Rovers, founded in 1899. Today the jerseys say 1901. What we know is that they register in 1901. For the first 2 years of their existence, Shamrock Rovers only play exhibition games. Whether that's the 2 years before 1901 or beginning in 1901 is a subject of great debate. So they're one of the only teams in Ireland that were founded in 2 years, 1899 and 1901. But those two clubs come along, and Shelburne and Bowes is a great rivalry from the beginning. C.S. Andrews, in that classic book, Dublin Made Me, he writes that he's at his holy confirmation, and him and all the kids around him are terrified that they're going to miss the Bowes Shells game, which is on at that time. He writes of this as being the great sporting rivalry in Dublin. Bohemians and Shelburne.
I want to go back to Paul, actually, because what's happening in the international scene here? When did I first play an international game?
Ireland played an international game in 1879-1880. And between 1880 and 1900, they played 46 internationals and they lose 37 of them. The only team they beat in that period is Wales. They concede a shed load of goals and don't seem to score too many. There's kind of, you can see how things change. It was because, I suppose, it took a while for the game to spread beyond Belfast. It had spread into Bowes and parts of Dublin, but it was only in 1898 that the Leinster Football Association was established, only in the early 1900s that the Fermanagh and West Association Football Association was founded, and then after that, I think it was 1906, the Munster Football Association, 1901, the Munster Football Association. So it's very slow spreading across the game, so there isn't a critical mass, and crucially, although there was a professional league in Ireland from 1894, the league professionalised most of the clubs. Seven of the eight clubs were based around Belfast, and the game hadn't got the critical mass. It didn't have the number of players that either Scotland or England had. Therefore, Ireland were routinely beaten in those matches.
Now, it didn't stay like that. I'm going to throw this one open to the audience. What was Ireland's most successful soccer team? Anybody? I mean, in your opinion,
what's your criteria?
What would you?
You mean club team?
No, international. When was Ireland's most successful international soccer team? Italian 90? 1988? Nobody? 1914, right? Because we won the what was then called the Home International Championship. Am I right there, Paul?
1914, yeah.
And that was the big breakthrough. That was the first time we...
And this was the big moment where Irish soccer had come of age, and Irish soccer, there were so many players now gone over to the English professional leagues who were playing with the best clubs in England. And they were not just playing with the best clubs in England, but were amongst the best players with the best clubs in England. And seemed set fair to dominate after 1914, but then
the
war started and everything. International soccer is abandoned.
Just before we move on to the war, I'll give you the results. We beat England 3-0, right? We beat Wales 2-1. And then we were 1-0 down against Scotland with 10 men, and we equalised. And we ended up at 5 points, top the table. So that is the only time, bar I think that triangular competition we won in Iceland in 1986. Yeah. That's the only bit of silverware Ireland ever won. There you go now.
We won last year.
Carling Nations
Cup. The Carling Nations Cup.
Let's move on.
Now, Donald. Let's just talk about the influence of the war, right? You've got some figures there, well, the First World War, because that cut a swathe through sport throughout the island.
How you show football as being the game of the working class in Dublin is by looking at the numbers of people that are playing football. And the way you do that is by going to the Phoenix Park and looking at what was being played in the Phoenix Park. There were 32 separate playing pitches in the Phoenix Park at the beginning of the 20th century. All but three of them were soccer pitches. Three were for Gaelic Athletic Association games. And when you look at the numbers who are applying to use those pitches, in 1913 there were 2,272 applications by association football teams, 52 by Gaelic teams, 38 by hurling.
Wow, that's huge.
It's huge.
Brian, have you any idea what those figures would be today, in terms of Phoenix Park pitches used for soccer or GAA? I mean,
well, Dublin City Council pitches, I'm sure the proportions would be very similar.
Right. So overwhelmingly, it's soccer, like. Yeah.
This is.
I wouldn't be sure the proportions are as vastly weighted towards soccer as that anymore. Yeah. I think if you look, look at the areas around Dublin where previously, say the GAA was dormant. You go across the way to the south side, which might have been previously rugby areas, and the GAA has an awful lot of children playing games now.
I wasn't trying to count all the number of people playing the game. I was asked the question, who's applying to hire public pitches? The GAA has many of its own pitches.
That tells its own story, of course, as well.
That figure, 2,272 in 1913, in 1915 the number is 1,452. And that's a huge drop, and what that shows is that it's a game of the working class, because who's gone to war at that point is the working class across Dublin. And with the outbreak of the First World War, the number of applications to play football in the park has gone through the floor. So that gives you an indication of it being the game of the poor, the working class. When the war breaks out, the partition of Irish soccer begins there, because Shelburne and Bohemians are forced to play in Leinster leagues, as opposed to the national one they had been competing in. So the war brings about the partitioning of Irish football in its own way, long before even the revolutionary period kicks in. People often think that that's what brings about partition in Irish soccer, a new Irish nationalist feeling. Really, it's the war. You can't play an All-Ireland League in those kind of situations, and Shells and Bows are forced into the Leinster equivalent.
David, I move on to you now, moving into the revolutionary period. So what's happening during the War of Independence and the Civil War?
I suppose I can best speak about what the game is like in Munster. And from 1901 you have the Munster Football Association setting up. And there's actually, for a little while around 1910, 1912, there's quite a considerable sort of critical mass for playing soccer, particularly in Cork. Now, it's getting there in Waterford, but not to the same extent. But Cork is really picking it up. In Tipperary, Care Park, they're founded in 1910. They're really significant for the development of soccer in South Tipperary, basically through the whole 20th century. But what you find is, again, a bit like Dublin, that sort of cuts off with the war, and then once you're moving into the kind of independence era, like War of Independence era, the game just, particularly in Cork, just seems to stop dead. Which is probably not surprising in Cork, especially Cork City and West Cork. Where there were pockets of it, it tends to decline. Even rugby is very, very limited, often only for charity matches to raise relief money for the Red Cross. You see a lot of that sort of stuff, but by and large, you don't really see much soccer action in parts of Munster for a long time. Really, again, until kind of 1921, 1922, and it starts to kind of gain momentum once again, and it seems to happen kind of, I think, a little bit around the country, but from what I can see of Munster, the game pretty much, you know, it's really there about 1914, 1915, and it just grinds to a halt till about 23.
One thing that happens during the War of Independence in the northeast in the country is that sectarianism becomes a big, big problem. In 1919, the Irish Cup semi-final was between Glentoran and Belfast Celtic, and the newspaper reports are great. They're talking about the national anthems being sung, there's flag waving, sectarian chanting and the like, and that leads to Belfast Celtic being temporarily, you know, removed from competitive football in the north. So by 1919, if you have a political and social revolution occurring in a country, the stress that causes, it influences everything. And it definitely comes into football across the whole island. But sectarianism in Northern Irish football, the big problem with the height of the War of Independence.
Paul, I want you to bring you in here, because
it happened there already, though. If you look at 1912, 1913, there was a major riot between Linfield and Belfast Celtic supporters, in which something like 47 people were hospitalised after something, a huge riot.
Do you think Belfast Celtic were... Do you think they were punished more so than Glentoran in 1919? Do you think there was sectarianism at the top, which punished Belfast Celtic? Were they disproportionately punished?
This is the big debate. Like, why did the split happen? Yeah. I suppose it's sometimes said, why is it that soccer alone of all sports in Ireland split, where rugby association went, kept together 32 county hockey, athletics to a lesser extent, for a while athletics. But it's kind of not a fair question, because although the GAA is 32 county, it had long since essentially partitioned on a nationalist unionist point. So what was it that drove soccer into two sections? And on one level it was politics and it was sectarianism, but on another level it was also a dispute between power brokers, the power brokers who ran the Leinster Football Association and those who ran the IFA from Belfast. And it was a dispute over, as happens, and it's one of those things, and maybe it's something we talk about after, if there is a possibility of the IFA and the FAI uniting, who will stop this, or why will it be stopped? And sometimes it's bureaucrats at the top who guard their own position and who promote their own position which causes these things.
But Paul, wouldn't it be true to say that this was a long time coming? I mean, that regardless of, you know, the country being physically partitioned, that there was a partition there going way back.
But what partition?
In the sense that a tension between the Belfast-based clubs and the rest of the country. Would that be a fair comment?
Well, it was a tension based around the fact that for 25 years, Belfast was untouched as the heart of Irish soccer, and it was the growth of the game in Dublin caused huge tension between the two. So in that sense, it was growing. And that growth is not necessarily to do with politics, it's to do with power.
Yeah, right. My sense in hearing the stories about the early days is of this club, is that the Belfast power brokers, as Paul refers to them, just saw the Southerners as usurpers.
Yeah.
I mean, they owned the cup, they owned the administration of football in Ireland, and they didn't take kindly to these upstarts. And they did not expect that Bowes would win a cup as early as they did, which was still, I think, early 1900s, 1908. Yeah.
But could you explain to me, like, the audience now, how did this Belfast-based leadership manage to get hold of the franchise, if you know what I mean? I mean, because it was the Irish Football Association.
They didn't get hold of the franchise, they started the franchise.
Okay.
It was their franchise. They set up the Irish Football Association in 1880, clubs, and it was from there that the league was run. It was from there that the dominant clubs were based. It's where the greatest crowds went. It's where the professional soccer was largely based. And it was only in the early years of the 20th century that Dublin began to gain critical mass against the Belfast, and more power shifted down in this direction. So it's not that they gained control of it, they had it.
Just an anecdote I heard earlier today, we had some people come in to hear about the history of the club, and somebody came in right at the very end and introduced herself as the grandchild of J.J. McCarthy, who played for Bowes in the 1920s and played for the Sarah Start Aaron team, and she had one of his caps. And she was very moved then to see the pictures of him. And Stephen Burke, is Stephen here? Stephen was able to tell her the wonderful story that in a match the Bohemians played against a Northern team, must have been Linfield, I think, where we were absolutely slaughtered. That sounds literal. I don't mean that. We were beaten on the field of play. and there was a lot of tension around the match. And the Bowes team got off the field fairly quickly. The Linfield, as I think it was, supporters came onto the field. J.J. McCarthy was the last man on the field.
they thought his number was up. And in fact, the Linfield supporters, because he had played so well, lifted him up on their shoulders and carried him off. So sometimes sport triumphs over sectarianism.
And as part of that, one of the major sporting occasions in Ireland in the 1890s and the early 1900s was the annual interprovincial match between Leinster and Ulster in soccer. I mean, there were larger crowds went to see that than went to see the international matches. That's very nice. Can you